Unveiling the secrets A-list copywriters use to make themselves and their clients millions. This is the Copywriters Podcast with your host, the world's greatest copywriting coach, David Garfinkel.
Today, we take a deep dive into the part of copywriting people talk about all the time. And even though people talk about this all the time, most of them don't really understand it. That is psychology. Not the kind of psychology you experience in a therapist's office, although there's a little overlap. It's not what you'd find in a brightly colored grid of buyer personas. It's not mindset. No, we're talking about the psychology that has to do with how people really behave. What makes them actually respond? It's the kind of psychology that proves out over and over again through unforgiving tests in the marketplace. We call it copywriting psychology. It's the psychology behind the copy that converts. And so we've got a crash course for you today in copywriting psychology. Just after this very non-psychological message, copy is powerful. You're responsible for how you use what you hear in this podcast. And most of the time, common sense is all you need. But if you make extreme claims, and if you're ready to copy for offers in highly regulated industries, like health, finance, and business opportunity, you may want to get a legal review after you write and before you start using your copy. My larger clients do this all the time. So here's the thing about copywriting psychology. It's not always polite. It may not even be pleasant. And sometimes it's offensive to the way people look at the world and wish it would be. But copywriting psychology is not trying to win a popularity contest. Instead, it's trying to answer a very serious and sometimes uncomfortable question, and that is, does it convert? Remember, we're talking about persuasion in the wild here. After all, when your prospects are looking at your copy, they aren't really sitting in a focus group, ponderously exploring their feelings and trying to express them so as to look good in front of others. Here's what your prospects are really doing. They're scrolling through emails. They're half watching TikTok videos. They're trying to remember where they left their debit card. Copywriting psychology doesn't rely on a theory or a particular set of beliefs. It relies on observed and measured behavior. Therefore, to get really good at this, you have to learn not to listen so much to what people say, but to pay very close attention to what people do. When I mentor clients, a large part of what we do ends up coming from developing an almost sixth sense for copywriting psychology. What we'll do here today is a crash course to help you move to the next level in this important set of copywriting tools.
Just going to make a note about, it's not about what people say, it's about what people do. I had a girlfriend one time, and this has happened more than one time, but one time specifically, who got with me and was attracted to my arrogant, cocky nature, spent years trying to beat that out of me and tell me I needed to be more sensitive and more empathetic. And as soon as she finally won the battle, she lost all attraction to me. So we broke up. I went back to my original nature, went back into building my business and having that confident nature, and she came running back. So what she said she wanted was the opposite of what her actions showed she wanted. And I've noticed this is true in copy as well. If you show somebody a sales page and they say, oh, that's amazing, I wouldn't run with that sales page. But if you show them a sales page and they say, dude, how do I buy that? Go with their actions rather than their words.
Yeah, boy, there's a lot to unpack in that story, but I won't. I mean, it's great though. And well worth everyone else thinking about too. All right, let's get back into our crash course. So first part of the course is persuasion through conversational stories. And the first thing we're going to talk about is persuasion stories. Now, these are very simple conversational stories, but they're focused on creating a specific outcome in your prospect's brain. They bypass resistance because that's what stories do. especially ordinary sounding plain spoken stories. When we're reading or hearing a story, our brains tend to go into a different, more receptive, more open mode. In my book, The Persuasion Story Code, I list 25 kinds of stories. Since this is a crash course, we'll just cover three of the easiest and most powerful types of stories to show you what they're like and how they work. First one, stories about your prospect's pain. In this kind of story, you describe the prospect's pain maybe better than they can describe it themselves, and along the way, you gain their trust. Suppose you had a product for marketers and copywriters that helps you create next-level offers. Here's a two-sentence persuasion story about a prospect's pain. You ever sit there at midnight rewriting the same subject line 5 times, wondering if it's you or it's just not a good offer? This is where I was when I realized something had to change. Now, one thing to emphasize, in this two-sentence story, you're not solving anything yet. And you're certainly not selling anything at this point. Too early. What you're doing is showing that you've been there. And that's what makes this work. Second kind of persuasion story is a reassurance story about others who made it work. This is like a very casual mini case study. It goes this way. Someone like you tried this. They weren't sure, but then it worked. It gives your prospect a little more confidence in what you're selling. Here's a really quick one. Guy told me he almost refunded the course because it felt too basic, but he gave it 3 more days. Landed a client the next week using one of the opening lines from Module 2. Notice, there's really no big promise in this persuasion story. It simply tells of a quiet little success, and that builds trust. Okay, third kind, unexpected benefit story. Here, you talk about the outcomes they never expected. But once they hear about it, they want what you're selling, like this. Someone joined our course for the headline training, but ended up using one of our welcome emails to revive a dead client list. Book 6K in work from that one email. Now, notice, you're not changing anything about your product. You're simply describing an unexpected benefit your prospect might not have thought of. And somehow, because of this description, the offer feels bigger, more valuable. So the point of these stories is not to create a dramatic effect or prove beyond all doubt that you have the perfect product. The idea here is to give a little slice of life that increases trust and builds desire along the way.
I just want to reemphasize the importance of what you started that off with, which is stories naturally put people's guard down. They let you take the driver's wheel and lead them to where they're going to go eventually. A sales message usually does the opposite. It raises red flags, puts people's defenses up, and raises their skepticism. So using stories like this, and plug for Persuasion Story Code, using stories like this is a great way, especially in the beginning of your sales message, to lower those resistance barriers, skepticism, and get people open to hearing the rest of the message.
Yeah, thanks. Totally agree. Okay, let's go to the next part of our copywriting psychology crash course, copywriting reflexes. I've never heard anyone else talk about copywriting reflexes, so I guess I'll have to plant the flag and claim authorship and say I invented the term. Copywriting reflexes are the instincts you develop that lets you write faster, think more clearly, make better decisions. And also, copywriting reflexes help you spot opportunities for persuasion before anyone else does. Oddly enough, these reflexes don't come from talent, and you don't get them from handwriting someone else's copy over and over again for hours on end. You build your copywriting reflexes over time, through repetition of the basics, through deliberate practice, where you correct faulty thinking and writing habits, through feedback from someone who's more experienced than you, and from thinking about what you noticed and why it worked or why it didn't work. They're such a big part of copywriting psychology. These reflexes give you speed without panic. They give you a way to be confident based on experience and intuition. It's a nice place to be. Here's what it looks like in real life. You're just talking with someone, you hear a phrase in conversation, and you think, that's a hook. You're watching TV, and you're looking at a commercial or an infomercial, and you see the headline buried inside the product demo. You write something, and instead of tinkering with it for 2 hours, you know within 10 seconds whether it's strong or weak. That's what copywriting reflexes do for you. And I've seen what happens when people don't have them. They hesitate. They hem and haw. They lean on formulas too long, and they don't know how to fix things when the formula doesn't work. And the worst thing happens, they burn hours chasing the wrong thing. They never get that time back. Now, I've worked with a lot of people over the years. Some had talent, but those people only succeeded if they had what the other less talented people who succeeded also had, work ethic. And people who did not have a lot of innate talent, many of them were enormously successful because they put in the time and effort. They practiced like it mattered. One client wrote great emails, but for years he couldn't get anyone interested in having him write a sales letter or a VSL script. Yet he kept going. He let me critique his work without getting defensive, and he used what he learned, and he improved. To the point where when he launched a company with a VSL he wrote himself, the company did $1 million in its first month. That's what slowly and carefully developed copywriting reflexes can eventually do for you. These reflexes are what let you write at a high level and think at a high level too. And once those reflexes are in place, they don't go away. They're part of how you think now.
I think this is more important than ever now that a lot of copywriters are leaning on AI. One thing that I've noticed is AI will spit out a bunch of ideas. If you don't know how to look at those ideas, you've called it the magic eye. If you don't know how to look at those ideas and pick out what's good, what's bad, or one that might be good, but what's wrong with it, and feed that back, you're not going to get anything amazing out of AI and the ability to actually utilize it as a tool to its most efficiency is all of the stuff that you just talked about right here.
I agree. This stuff is more important now that AI is so front and center. All right, let's get to our next section, emotional triggers and human nature. Emotion, of course, is what spurs people to buy, and I'm sure you've heard that before. But how do you actually use emotion in your copy? A lot of people think using emotion means piling on adjectives. Next level, awesome, tremendous, the best ever. Or telling some mind-boggling rags-to-riches story. Or screaming in all caps about how amazing your product is. But that's not how to create the emotion you want. It's how to create full-blown skepticism. What you want to create is heartfelt emotion. Creating emotion with your copy means understanding what your prospect is already feeling and tapping into that feeling in an authentic sounding way to amplify it organically. Now, there's a whole spectrum of emotions that prompt people to buy. Here's just a few of them. Fear, greed, envy, guilt, shame, anger, hope, pride, belonging, status. What you need to do is pick the one or two that align most closely with how your prospect ordinarily makes a buying decision for your kind of offer. Not all of them, just a handful, usually just one or two. I've seen a lot of copy fall flat because the approach to emotion was wrong. Here's what I mean. You're selling a high-end consulting offer and you lean on greed. But the real reason someone buys consulting like that is not greed, it's fear. It's fear of staying stuck, fear of wasting time, fear of looking like an idiot in front of the board. With a different kind of buying decision, you need to tap into a different emotion. Or maybe you're selling a lifestyle product like skincare, and you lean too hard on the fear of aging. That might work on some buyers, but it turns out that most of the market for your particular skincare product is more motivated by status and pride, how they feel walking into the room, knowing they look great. When it comes to emotion, it all depends on who you're writing to and what problem your product is solving for them. Now, here's where people get tripped up. They try to explain emotions. That's like trying to explain a joke when nobody laughs. You just end up digging yourself deeper into a hole. You can't tell someone to feel fear or shame or envy. You have to lead them into it. How? With stories, with sensory detail, with tension and contrast, not with logic. Here's an example. Quote, you're on a Zoom call and the client asks a question you can't answer. You feel your stomach tighten. You nod like you know, but you're already sweating. Close quotes. You've just helped your prospect remember the shame of looking like an idiot in front of a client. Good start. Or this, quote, your friend posts another vacation picture. This time it's Bora Bora. You think about your bank balance. Then you keep scrolling. That's expanding the envy they're already feeling. You don't need to say the words shame or envy. They feel it. And once they feel it, they're open. Now here's the flip side. You don't leave them there. You map out a path to the place where you can present your product as the answer or the solution. The better you get at identifying and eliciting the right emotion, the easier it will be for your prospect to buy from you.
The one trip up that I think that some people have is they say, well, my market makes very logical decisions. And the truth of the matter is, even the most logical amongst us are subconsciously led around by our emotions.
Yeah, there are a few rare cases where like a professional buyer or purchasing agent will make a logical decision. But again, that's out of fear of their boss accusing them not making a logical decision.
I've noticed B2B lean a little bit less on the emotion and more just what does this mean for your bottom line? But anytime B2C, it's always going to be emotion led.
Definitely. All right, let's get to the next part of our crash course. And it's the secret sauce most people kind of know about, but don't really pay enough attention to. And that's believability. Because even if your offer is strong, even if your story is great, even if you hit the perfect emotional trigger, if your reader doesn't believe you, nothing else really matters. It's like this. You can have the perfect headline, the best story, and a brilliant offer, and still lose the sale quietly and completely because your reader didn't trust what you said. So that's why you need proof. Now, proof doesn't have to be complicated. All it has to be is real, specific, and relevant. Proof does not simply mean dropping in a few testimonials and checking a box in your checklist, because you need to make sure that the proof you use reduces resistance. The job your proof needs to do is silence the voice in your reader's head that says, I don't know if this is legit. So let's walk through how to do that. Here are a few types of proof that I come back to again and again. Specific results, demonstrations, contrasts before and after, customer stories, data, stats, and numbers, credentials and authority, visuals, screenshots, graphs, images, guarantees, warranties, risk reversals. But here's the catch. You don't want to just stack them up and throw them at the reader. That turns into noise and mental overload. You want to use the right kind of proof at the right moment. So, example, let's say you're making a bold claim. This email template brought in $40,000 in 4 days. Okay, you've just triggered a red flag. Now the reader's on alert. You need to bring in specific, relevant proof right away. Maybe it's a screenshot of the sales report. Maybe it's a short story about a client who used the email. Maybe it's your own credentials, the fact that you've written hundreds of successful promos before this one. But you need something there. You can't just make a bold claim without supporting it and expect people to believe it. It's the same thing with the promise of transformation. If you say, This program helped a business owner double their revenue in 30 days, and you need to prove that that person exists. Show the story, include the detail, be specific. Jim was making $18K a month, stuck for 6 months straight. After week two of using our system, he booked 3 new clients. By the end of that month, he had cleared $39K. See what that does? It makes the story harder to dismiss. It's not a lot of details, but it's the right kind of details that make it work as believable proof. Now, I know as copywriters and marketers, we like to spice things up. But proof doesn't always need to be dramatic. In fact, sometimes the most believable thing you can do is show the real-world limitations of your offer. For example, we can't promise this will work for everyone. If you're not willing to put in at least 5 hours a week, this probably isn't for you. That makes the rest of your copy feel more grounded. It signals to the reader, this person isn't blowing smoke. And one more thing, format matters. Screenshots work, video clips work, direct quotes work. But they only work if they support your big idea, not distract from it. Don't let proof become decoration. Finally, if you've done everything else, hit the emotion, told the story, framed the offer, then the proof is the one thing that makes it stick.
I'm wondering your opinion on this. I've noticed that having very subtle proof, like above the fold on a web page, underneath the hero section, just a real quick trusted by logo, 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 or featured on media logo, media logo, media logo. And then also in the introduction story, just having a simple, if it's legit, having Dr. So-and-so was working in this field and kept running into this roadblock, and then on a trip to Japan discovered that the people there weren't having the same problem. And but just having that Dr. So-and-so, not a huge like Dr. So-and-so has 50 PhDs and blah 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 blah, but just a real subtle Dr. So-and-so and a real subtle trusted by or working with blah 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 right at the beginning of the sales page seems to dismantle that skepticism. Really subtle pieces of proof that go a long way as far as getting people to already have pre-framed belief as they read the rest of the message.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I agree. So the kind of things you're talking about, like the media logos or, you know, trusted by or bringing in someone with a very high level of universally accepted authority, like a doctor, it is a kind of proof. I would certainly call it believability. I think what it proves is that you're in the world of legitimate people, because people who their whole business is to make other people legitimate, like the media networks, the cable networks and so forth, have crowned you as legitimate. And, you know, that's like a starting point, right? People, they wonder when they ever they find someone new they haven't heard of before, they wonder if it's a scam. So it doesn't necessarily prove everything you say is true, or it doesn't prove your specific points. But and like you say, it's subtle, but it positions you in the category of someone who's legit and someone who I could trust, not feel like a fool for doing so.
What I think it does is it appeals to our tribal nature. I'm afraid to leave the cave and go out and maybe get attacked by a saber-toothed tiger. But I saw that Joe did it, and I saw that Mary did it, and I saw that Bill did it. And I also saw the guy that gets a lot of respect from the tribe. He went out and did it as well. And so now I feel a little bit more comfortable. So when I see those little subtle nods to, hey, the tribe says that this is okay, the people that the tribe respects say that this is okay, it's probably okay.
That's a perfect way to put it. And I think that's a level of proof that we don't talk about a lot. I don't think people understand it too well, but I think you described it perfectly. It's not like tactically obvious. It's kind of deeper, but it is how we think all the time. So that's great. Okay, let's go to our last part of the crash course. The final part of our crash course has to do with zeroing in on your prospect's level of awareness. And it's a common mistake to assume consciously or unconsciously to assume the wrong level of awareness. You might assume your reader knows too much, or you could assume they know less than they actually do. Either way, a wrong assumption about awareness can totally wipe out other gains you've made in copywriting psychology. Awareness has everything to do with what kind of offer your prospect will be receptive to. Now, let's give credit where credit is due. This idea comes from Eugene Schwartz, and he nailed it years ago, like 50, like 70, 60 years, 60. He nailed it 60 years ago in Breakthrough Advertising. He laid out five stages of awareness: most aware, product aware, solution aware, problem aware, and completely unaware. And each level tells you something critical about how close your reader is to buying and what they need to hear next to take the next step. So most aware means they know your product. They want it. They just need a good deal, like a great price or special bonuses. And if that's the case, don't make it any more complicated than it has to be. Just give them the deal. Now, product aware means they know what you're selling, but they're not sure if it's right for them yet. Maybe a competitor is better. They haven't decided. So you focus on clear reasons why yours is the best choice. Okay, moving down the awareness scale, solution aware means they know the kind of thing they need, like I need a sales funnel, but they don't know you yet or your product or your system for funnels. So now your copy has to educate them about your product, not just give reasons about it, but start at a lower level of awareness. What your copy needs to convince them of is not only is this the right kind of solution, but mine is the one that works. Now, problem aware means they know something's wrong, but they don't know about solutions. They don't know what fixes it yet. This is where you talk about the pain, the real cost of staying stuck. You're not pitching a product yet. You're deepening their understanding of the problem. You're warming them up to finding out about solutions. And then there's completely unaware. It's the hardest one. They're not looking for you or your solution. They don't even know there's a problem. In this case, you need to find a way to get them engaged in your copy and take them through at least one or more of the higher stages of awareness. Most people don't take the time to figure out the prospect's level of awareness and tailor their copy to it, and they lose sales because of this. See, when you write copy that's one or two levels above where your prospect really is, you just don't connect. But when you get it right, then your message feels personal and right in line with where they're at. And that's when your prospect says yes. All right, you want to recap?
I'm going to ask a question real quick, actually. A rule of thumb, I generally just avoid writing to level five completely unaware. I'm not even interested in trying to get those people's attention whatsoever. And problem aware people, I've noticed writing two-step, like a, hey, here's this problem. You might not even know there's a solution to it. Go check out this free webinar where we talk all about it. And it takes a pretty significant amount of world building and emotional triggers, and then moving them through going, like I was talking about, Dr. So-and-so is dealing with this problem, and in Western medicine, he kept hitting the pharmaceutical roadblocks, but then he went to Japan and he found that the people never even suffer from this. That's the lowest that I go. Because it requires so much work at that level four problem aware people. And I just don't even bother going after level five completely aware. And if I can avoid the problem aware people, I tend to like going for the people who already know the solution, and I just need to convince them or show them why my solution is better. What are your thoughts on that, though? Should I know Eugene Schwartz included those bottom two for a reason, because there's money in them, but it seems like the completely aware people, it's just diminishing returns. The amount of money that I have to spend to get them on board is just not worth it when I can go after the top three levels.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about two clients I have, and without revealing a whole lot of details, one of them has a potential market in the tens of millions, and one of them has multi-millions, but maybe not as many, but millions. And they've got people in categories 4 and 5, and they are spending an enormous amount of money and making even more money working on it. But, you know, they have large teams of media buyers. They have a few copywriters. They're doing all kinds of CRO stuff. When I meet with them, sometimes they'll show me these spreadsheets that make my eyes glaze over, because I had one client who, they were probably a 9-figure company, and I was working with their head of copy, and he showed me this chart at which point on any given video attention fell off. And I mean, they just segmented it, like, and it's a different business than a more entrepreneurial or less competitive or less ambitious, you know, B2C or B2B company is. So, you know, Gene was writing with big advertisers in mind, obviously. And personally, for my own business, I would prefer the, you know, top two or top three myself. But there, like you say, there's money there. It's just, it's a different way of doing business. It's a different level of analysis and energy and investment and, you know, people. So, yeah, different world, but interesting. Not necessarily what I want to do, but I do help people with it, and they know what they're doing, and they just do it a little differently.
I know a number of years back, I was writing for a supplement company, and we had nailed the top two. We were like the predominant of the people that knew about us. We were the number one. And then we started going into the solution aware, and we did okay there. But as soon as we stepped into the problem aware, we ended up spending two or three times as much to get somebody on board. And if, because it was supplements, we could have the upsells and we could have the continuity and we could make it worth it. The lifetime value was worth it, but it almost wasn't. And then, so looking at the five completely aware, I was just like, I don't even want to try.
No, I don't blame you. And, you know, it all depends on what your goals are, what your copywriter, your client's goals are, if you're a business owner, what your own vision is. Might be worth it, might not, but you have to consider the costs and weigh them against the benefits, or consider the benefits. I don't know. You have to weigh them one against another.
You have to do a cost-benefit analysis.
There you go. All right. So let's recap section one of this crash course. Persuasion through conversational stories, short, simple stories that bypass resistance and help your prospect feel seen. And you don't need to drama. You just need a believable moment that connects emotionally, builds trust. Section two, copywriting reflexes. These are reflexes you write with speed, clarity, confidence, without overthinking every word. You build them through focused practice and sharp feedback until good copy becomes nearly automatic. Section three, emotional triggers and human nature. People don't buy on logic, they buy on emotion. Your job is to identify the core emotion behind the decision and elicit it with precision. Section four, believability and proof. If your copy isn't believable, it'll be very hard to make a sale. Use relevant, specific proof to dissolve doubt and earn trust at the points where all these things are needed. And as we were just talking about prospect awareness, section five, your message really works when it matches your reader, where the reader is right now. You get the awareness level right, and the rest of your copy becomes a lot easier. So I've got a couple resources for you if you want to get copywriting psychology under your belt. If you are a working copywriter with at least 2 years experience and income in the 6-figure level or higher, you should consider applying for mentorship with me. I don't work with beginners, but if you have a successful business and you write copy, or you have a strong freelance copywriting business, check out my mentoring. It's a serious 1-year program, and it can easily take you to the next level. It's expensive, but clients find again and again that it more than pays for itself. In fact, some of them who, as I was talking about before, run 9-figure businesses have stayed with me for years. Now, they wouldn't do that unless they weren't getting something out of it. So obviously they are. And some freelance copywriters have stayed with me for years as well. Now, what we talked about today is just a small part of the copywriting psychology we cover during the year of mentoring, first year. So most of it comes up when we go over projects and promotions you're actively working on. And you can find out more about all this, including an application at GarfinkelCoaching.com. And I'll put the link in the show notes. The second resource is for everyone, and I can't recommend it highly enough, even though I wrote it. This week, I got two messages from two clients who were bragging that they got someone else to get the book. Why? Because they know the information and it can really make a big difference in your copy and in your business, even if you're not a copywriter. And I haven't seen the information in the Persuasion Story Code anywhere else. So it's on Amazon, and I'll put the link in the show notes. And that's all I got to say.
Wow. Okay. This week reminded me of some of the earlier episodes where we just did a full-on copywriting course, more so than just a podcast. So thank you for putting this together. I will make sure to put a link to GarfinkelCoaching.com and a link to the Persuasion Story Code in the show notes over at CopywritersPodcast.com. While you're there, check out the library, 400 and almost 40 episodes of quality copywriting content. So check that out as well. David, thanks again, man. And until next time, we will catch you later.
Thank you. Catch you later. Before we go, a quick question. Would you like to have me as a guest on your podcast? Let me give you an easy way to contact me about that. We've put up a form on GarfinkelMedia.com, and it won't take much more than a minute to fill it out. So if you'd like to have me on your show, just go to GarfinkelMedia.com and fill out the form. That's GarfinkelMedia.com. Thanks, and see you next time on the Copywriters Podcast.